Welcome to Hashtag No Limits. I am your host, Shelley Kino, and Hashtag No Limits is about people that society has placed limits upon but who are busting through those limits. Ophelia says in Hamlet, we know what we are but not what we will become. And I believe that to be 100% true, and I've kind of tweaked it a little bit to we know who we are but not who we will become. And I believe that there is not a better or more beautiful example than the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. And a very quick, very simplified science lesson is that the caterpillar literally dissolves into its cells, and just when it must think its life is over, it reforms into the butterfly. But that's not finished. It still has to struggle in order for its wings to be strong enough once it gets out of the cocoon in order to take it everywhere it's going to soar to. That can't be easy, but I know that busting through limits that society has placed upon us is not easy either. And that's why I do this show. I want to share with the world how we can support those in busting through limits, like the cocoon that is necessary to be there to support someone. And just like the caterpillar turning into that butterfly is supported. And so I'm hoping that perspectives get changed, eyes are opened, hearts are expanded, and we can make this world better for all. One person, one interaction at a time. For those of you who are watching or listening, please give us a like or subscribe. If you are watching and you would like to comment, please give us a hashtag live and where you're watching from. And be sure to include any comments or questions in the chat. If you are watching in the replay, do the same thing, except hashtag replay. And if you do ask any questions or have any comments, I will make sure that my guest those if they are directed toward the guest. And if it's anything that I need to answer, I will answer you as well. Again, thank you for joining me. And today my guest is Jessica. She is a mom of two children, and she is going to share about the journeys that both boys, I'm not sure, she didn't even tell me if it was boys, both kiddos have taken. But specifically, we're going to focus on the one child who has dyslexia and autism. So let me bring on Jessica. Hi, Jessica. How are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for joining me in your car. Hopefully this doesn't mean you're driving, but you're just actually sitting in your car relaxing. So Jessica, tell us a little bit more about yourself and about your kids.
So my name is Jessica Berg. I am an instructional coach here in Rockford, Illinois at Ellis Elementary. I've been there for 7 years, and before that I was a middle school teacher that taught English, so 20 total years in education. I have two boys. I have a 16-year-old who Shelley mentioned has autism and dyslexia. I also have an 11-year-old son who is actually on the other side of the spectrum. He does attend the Gifted Academy, and things come much easier to him. So I've really gotten to experience both sides of that coin as a parent.
That's a lot of challenges right there, mm-hmm. raising two kiddos who are both neurodivergent, and being what you, like you said, kind of, you know, opposite ends of the spectrum as far as needs go. So I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I just I just felt like that needed a comment.
And they're so different. My autistic dyslexic son, he's extremely hardworking. He really works through those challenges that he faces, and I feel like my youngest, he could be a little lazy. And he's gifted. So I feel, yeah, it's so funny how you raise your children with the same type of expectations, they turn out so different.
Well, and I think we forget, and I only have one, so, you know, I'm not experienced in having more than one, but I feel like we would all raise our children differently because they each have their own personalities, and they each are going to need something a little bit different, or maybe a lot different from one another. And I think the more children you have, the more difficult it becomes trying to make sure that each one is getting what they need. And we have a couple people joining us. I just want to give them a shout out. We've got Samantha Gibson, and we also have L Henry 18. So I appreciate you guys joining today, and please keep the comments coming. I appreciate you joining us live. So for those people who aren't familiar with an instructional coach, what exactly does that mean for educators, but also maybe what does that mean for parents and students?
As an educator, my role in the school is to really work with teachers to help improve student goals. So some people like to say, like, we teach teachers. I feel like that's a really quick way to put it, but it's so much more than that. It's really partnering with teachers to help students reach their goals in reading and in math. And it's actually stepping into this goal that really highlight this role that really highlighted where my oldest, his name is Logan, where his deficits were and what needed to be done to help him. Prior to that, I was a middle school English teacher, and when kids came to us, they should just know how to read. They should, right? But I know many of them don't, but I'd get students in my classroom that didn't know how to read. And as a middle school teacher, I had no idea how to help them. College had not prepared me for what I needed to learn to teach a child to read, let alone my son. So for many years, I just kind of went with those IEP meetings, and everyone was like, well, he just can't read because he has autism. And that wasn't the case at all. It was because he had dyslexia. And really diving into my professional journey of being a reading specialist, I learned what it is that Logan needed to be a successful reader. And it wasn't because of his autism.
And how awful to say, well, he can't read because he has autism. That's why I do this. I mean, honestly, that's one of the reasons, is because for anybody to say, to set that limit of, well, they can't do this because of X, I don't agree with that. We have so much technology. We have so many teaching methods. We have so many sensory options to just say, well, it's because of X that they can't do whatever.
It will come to him. I mean, I hear that right. So many, especially once he got into middle school, it really seemed like any opportunity he had to become a reader was lost. There was the supports he needed were not prevalent in middle school, and he'd just go the rest of his life reading at a kindergarten level. And I just have to be okay with that. And we weren't, and we found out once he had that dyslexia, diagnosis, I really feel it opened a lot of doors for us.
And I'm happy, but that's also a shame that they just gave up, basically, from what it sounds like, at least to me, is like, well, you know, we've tried very little, honestly, I'm guessing, and it doesn't work, and therefore your child's incapable. Versus this child is an individual. We've tried, you know, three things, but there are literal hundreds of things that we haven't tried, but we're not going to, because these three things didn't work, so nothing else will.
Exactly. It was just this canned curriculum that he wasn't being successful with because it wasn't, I think, explicit enough for what he needed. And he wasn't successful with that thing. They gave him an intervention, they checked their box. And it is what it was, so.
Yeah, and I do not believe, I'm going to preface this with, I am not a lawyer, but I am a certified special education teacher. I have always loved the law. I've always looked to the law for my guidance. And I do not believe that trying one intervention is all that the law asks or requires. It is providing an appropriate education. And I don't think that if we are only offering one or two options, that we are providing an appropriate education. Because like I said, we try two or three things and say, well, that's all there is. I don't think, if we compared this to a medical diagnosis of like any disease. And we just tried one or two treatments, and the medical professional said, oh, that's it. There's nothing else that we can do. I don't think anybody would be happy with that. I think they would want that person, that medical, or they would seek other medical professionals and say, this isn't it. There's got to be something else.
Yeah.
And with when it comes to kids who learn differently, I feel like we oftentimes let educators off the hook too early. As a special educator, I always felt like it was my job, my responsibility to keep trying things, because I couldn't see inside each of my students' brains, and I didn't know what would suddenly click with them. And so to just say, well, this method and this method didn't work, and these are the best methods that are out there, well, it's not the best method for that student. There's other things that could be tried. So just saying, well, we've tried what's out there, that's the best, and that's it, we're not doing anything else, I feel like we're doing a huge disservice to not only our students in that moment, but to society as a whole. Because if we, I mean, I hate to get down to, you know, bottom line money issues, but if we don't take the time to put the resources into the students when they're young and in a safer environment, such as a school environment, and we put them out of school and they can't read, they can't do math, they can't write, they can't problem solve, we're going to pay for them as a society later.
And as a whole, across the nation, what we thought was best for a long time was balanced literacy, having kids start with a level A and move on the way up, and explicit phonics instruction really fell on the wayside. We were putting all our eggs in a basket that wasn't working for our kids for a very, very long time. And that was the basket that Logan was in all the way through his elementary to middle school years, just because we didn't know better. And I really, there are still schools that fall in that balanced literacy category, but because of podcasts like Soul to Story and other podcasts that really highlight the science of reading, I really feel like it's been doing what's best for dyslexic learners and struggling learners. We're finding are really best for everybody, which is that explicit phonics piece.
Yeah, and I'm old enough that I have seen the cycles go through a couple of times. We as an education system will focus on one thing. Like when I was going through school, we did explicit phonemic. We didn't call it that. I mean, it wasn't called that, but I mean, I remember this whole genre called the letter people, where we went through and we learned about, you know, the vowels were Miss A, A, I, O, U, and the consonants were Misters. And we learned about all the different sounds, and then they were blends. And, you know, I mean, we did all these things. And then about the time I got out of high school and went back as a paraprofessional, we were more into the whole language, which is more the balanced literacy. And so, you know, we just keep, and like I said, I've seen it, and it always comes back with a little different spin on it because we've learned a little bit more. But again, nothing works for every single person. So balanced literacy may work for a lot of people, but also you're going to have a group of people who need explicit instruction in phonics.
I think the same is true with math and reading, is that we need to find the good in both. With reading, that there's phonics instruction is really important when you're a beginning reader, but that only takes you so far. At one point in time, then what you are then, instead of learning to read, you're reading to learn, and knowing when that takes place, and that both really hold their weight. And I think the same thing is true with math that we're seeing with my school, especially. We're really trying to focus on that math fat fluency. That's not something we're seeing anymore. Like the time tests are giving kids anxiety, so we're not doing it anymore. So we just stopped it. And that kids will just learn these concepts through lots of practice. There's got to be a balance of both. And so I feel like, yeah, we're just kind of like in this, you need to find that balance between the both and not going all in on one or the other. I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah. And so thank you. That was, we kind of went off on a little bit of a rabbit hole there of like, you know, how an instructional coach can help educators, but is there anything that an instructional coach does directly with the students or the parents, or is it just sort of indirectly that an instructional coach is helping the parents and the students?
I think indirectly a lot, because our main goal is to really work with teachers, but that impacts those other avenues. But in that vein, then we really do impact both of those things by our work through with the educators.
Right. Okay. Thank you for that. So one of the things I did just post in the chat is the two ways that people can find you and follow you. And I'll post this again later as we get into more about what you do. But you are on Facebook and on Instagram. And on Instagram, you are at Teacher I Am. And on Facebook, you are at Jessica Grodberg. So that was a Grod-Berg. And so, Jessica, talk to me about some of the things that I don't want to start with your 16-year-old yet. I want to start with your other son, because oftentimes we do focus on the kiddos that are having the sort of common, I kind of hate to use that word, but, you know, the ones that are more prevalent, I guess, is better to say. And so I want to talk about your son who's more on the other end of the spectrum. I guess he's your younger son. So tell us some of the things that he has struggled with and some of the ways that he has busted through some of those struggles and how the school was good with that and then not so good. Because we're human, so there's going to be goods and bads in all situations, no matter who we're working with, medical professionals, educators, whatever.
Yeah, so my youngest went to a small private school all the way up until fifth grade. And so he was in a class of 12 kids all throughout his elementary journey. And he was coming up at an end, and we really had to decide, like, are we going to keep going on the private route, or are we going to look at what public options there are? Because he was a straight A fifth grade student. So we decided our district offers special programming for gifted learners. So we decided to have him take the COVID test at the gifted middle school, and he tested in. And so it's been a little bit of a struggle for me personally as a parent, wondering if I've made the right choice, because he has struggled quite a bit. The workload is different. The expectations are much higher. The rigor is there. So I've always been wondering, like, is he a straight A sixth grade student because they do one grade level above, or is he a really struggling seventh grade student because he's in sixth grade this year? And I've just really had to let him embrace that journey and not put, I think, really unfair expectations on him. I know a lot of parents will, you know, might be like, you need to have the A's, you always need to shoot for the A's. I was like, I just want you to be happy. I want you to be healthy, and I want you to be flourishing, and whatever that looks like, it looks like. So he does have a few C's, and he struggles. I think sometimes his work ethic could really use some work, because he's really gotten kind of by on just kind of being that A student who just kind of floats. And so Right. He's really had to apply himself. And I've been really proud of him taking initiative to join the basketball team. Because he's always been very shy. He has some sensory disorders, I think, like his very similar to his brother. He, like, for example, we had to do like food therapy when he was younger. He has that textural sensory things. He still only eats like five foods. So I know going to a school where middle school, where a lot of kids don't pack their lunch, was going to be a huge challenge for him. And he's navigated that. So he has his own special challenges apart from his brother. But he does seem to see that his brother gets a lot more limelight than he does. I spoke at our church just recently. I'm a part of a pretty large church here in town. And so they did a video of, they come and they donate gifts to our school every year. And so I did a little piece on that. And the reason I joined that church is because they have a special needs ministry. So it really highlighted Logan, and then we get in the car and he's like, "So what about Logan?" And I'm like, "I know, I'm sorry, you know, it's just kind of how it is." But he finds his way to still shine, but his brother definitely gets a lot more of that light.
Yeah. And I so appreciate what you just mentioned about the fact that he is gifted, but he still can have some lower grades. And I appreciate that because so often we think or assume, or maybe we're not even thinking about it at all. We're just like, oh, the kid is gifted or the person is gifted. They must be gifted in everything. And that's a huge misnomer because our brains don't necessarily always grow at the same rates. And so maybe he's really gifted in math, but in this, and I don't mean this to sound like I'm talking about your son, but anybody can be really gifted in math, but really struggle in reading or writing or the opposite. Or maybe they are really gifted in academics, but not so gifted in social, emotional, or physical things. And yeah. So I appreciated that you brought that out, that, you know, like you said, is he a struggling seventh grader or a really gifted sixth grader? Because that it is a balancing act of trying to distinguish when you're talking about that, because he could be really gifted in, like I said, one or two areas and just be not as gifted or gifted at all in some of the other areas.
The first example you gave is him for sure. He loves math, but he really struggles in reading and writing. So,
yeah. And we forget that. Or like I said, maybe we don't even think about it because it's just like, oh, well, this person is gifted. So obviously they're gifted in everything. And that's not, I mean, I even saw this with my daughter and my niece as they were growing up. They're about 4 months apart. And they were both the firsts. And so, you know, as we were watching them grow, our daughter was really doing more physical things first, or hitting those milestones first. But my niece was really hitting some of the verbal and more kind of academic things first. And so, and then, I mean, they eventually caught up and, you know, developed well in everything, but it was really interesting to watch that happen. Like, oh, okay, I've studied about this, but I've never actually seen it. And I'm sure, like I said before, I only have one, but being able to have multiple children, you probably can see that happening as well.
I feel like I think Milo is my youngest son. I really think I struggled with diagnosing Milo earlier because of having an older child with autism. So lots of times Milo would do something, my husband and I would look at each other like, oh, that just must be what typical kids do. Instead of just assuming that maybe he was gifted, we just thought he was just a typical kiddo. Right. Because we hadn't seen what somebody who reaches those milestones appropriately had looked like. And so we made a lot of assumptions, I think, based on that.
And that makes such great sense. And sometimes you'll have the opposite when the first one is the gifted one and the second one doesn't hit the milestones, even at the average age. And then the parents are worried because they're comparing to the one who is gifted, like, uh-oh, you know, and they, you know, yeah. So I appreciate that dichotomy there of the opposite. I just appreciate that. I just appreciate that you brought that out. And so, so you said that Milo is starting to get involved with some extracurriculars. I want to talk about that for a second because again, academically, it seems that there's that where his giftedness lies, but maybe some of that social emotional stuff, he isn't at that same level, which maybe he is, you know, even delayed in that or just average level. And I think, again, we don't think about that. We don't take that into consideration when a student is struggling. To me, it seems like people that I've experienced who have so much strength in academics tend to really struggle with that social emotional side.
That's very true. I think a lot of the kids at his school struggle with that just because I think we have such high expectations for them in all areas that sometimes we forget mm-hmm. they're just kids and they're still developing. They have their outlets, they have their meltdowns, just like, you know, any other kid, doesn't matter if they're 12. So right. I definitely think that's very true.
Yeah. Yeah. So besides breaking through some of the social emotional stuff, what other things has he, or have you noticed that some limits have been placed upon him? And the limit, this is kind of a backwards limit, but it's, we expect him to be doing all of this. And so in essence, we're still putting that limit on it. It's just, it's a reverse limit. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's very true. Like, my husband and I will joke because he'll do something that seems so harebrained. We're like, come on, you're the gifted one. Like, and we'll say those things jokingly, but it's very true. I kind of feel like I'm an older sibling of a younger brother. And so even those limits that they put on you when you're older, too, you're like, come on, you're the oldest. Like, you know better. And these limits automatically get put on you just because of, who you are and when you were born in this instance. So, yeah.
Yeah. And so with how does he handle getting some of those grades that are less than A's when he's been so used to getting those A's?
He takes it pretty hard. Sometimes not as hard as I wish he would. But he will be like, you know, it's because of, so at his school, their grading system, I think, is really challenging. It's 90% summative and 10% formative. So if you don't do well in the test, it doesn't matter how much homework you did or how much worksheets in class you did. It really just comes down to that test. So it brings out this new anxiety that I don't think he knew was there, because that pressure wasn't there. Or sometimes it can be like unreal expectations, I think. So it's just been interesting watching him develop into this young man with these new expectations and pressures. And I think he's doing okay navigating it. It's been a challenge just because he's been with the same group of friends, you know, his whole life. And so moving away from friends, and that was especially when I taught middle school, whenever I met with parents, I always made it a point to tell parents like who they socially are hanging around with. Do they have friends? I feel like that's a whole piece that once we go to conferences that we don't really talk about with parents, but that's equally as important, that they are feeling they belong somewhere and with a group of friends. And so I do feel like Milo has really been flourishing in that area of finding his people. He's become this little social butterfly. I especially love going to his basketball games because all the seventh graders and eighth graders are in the stands cheering for the sixth grade team. They're like, Milo, that's my boy. That's my boy. And I was like, that's my boy. I just love hearing that he just has acceptance from his peers, which was just a big worry of mine. And I think that's one of the biggest worries that's been taken off my shoulders, is he just really enjoys the people he goes to school with. And the grades are going to come. We're just going to keep those expectations that as long as he's doing his best, that's okay for us. And but I don't want him to not like school. So it's definitely a balancing act.
Yeah, of course. And I appreciate that comment about, you know, the kids accepting him. And when you're at parent conferences, that we don't talk enough to the parents about their child's social interactions, because that does play such a huge role in the child's life, if in their academic life as well. And I don't think we often give that credit at all, let alone enough credit, for the fact that, you know, if you have a student who feels like everyone is always looking at them to make fun of them or is picking on them, or that they feel like they stand out very, you know, in a very negative way, that's going to affect how they're able to learn and how they're able to process what they're being taught. And so often I have encountered parents who their biggest concern, I would say they're a bigger concern than academics, is that social piece. And again, children who seem to be gifted seem to have that. I mean, I can remember that about people that I went to school with, that people who were, you know, the super intelligent ones were really awkward in social situations. And they didn't seem like
from Hard Rock, you know? So it was very awkward. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And they didn't know how to hang out with other people, and they didn't, it was too much energy. You know, again, absolutely. When you think about Sheldon, you know, he is a pretty good example of this, of like, it takes so much work to learn all the social nuances that the majority of the population just naturally come by.
And so I definitely see more of the social awkwardness of my oldest. He has really struggled with making friends his whole life. And so luckily both of their birthdays are like 2 weeks apart. So anytime we celebrate a birthdays, we always celebrate them together. So all of Milo's friends could also be Logan's friends, even though they were 5 years apart. So that way when Logan didn't have anybody come to the party, it's okay because we had all of Milo's friends. So we've been fortunate that Milo's always been the social one and then shares his friends with all of his older brother.
Yeah. And that makes a great segue into talking more about Logan and the things that he has gone through. And from my understanding, his journey has been much more difficult than Milo's.
Yes, for sure.
So what sort of things have been the biggest struggles when it has come to addressing the needs of Logan?
I think we were at an advantage of knowing that autism ran in my family. So when I found out I was pregnant with boys both times, I cried, not because I really did want a girl, but not only because they were boys, but I knew it was more prevalent in boys, autism was. And so I feel like we came in kind of with a knowledge that there was a really good chance. So our radar was pretty up when it came to Logan's developmental challenges when he was pretty young. So we were pretty fortunate to get connected with Child Family Connections here in town. That was a free parent advocacy for children with special needs. So we were able to get him the help he needed right away when he was just three. So entering public school, we already had an IEP because of the work that we had done when he was in pre-K. And from there, he really struggled. So Logan has, I hate the term, but he has high functioning autism. If you were just to meet Logan, you would just think he's strange, a little strange. But other than that, you wouldn't probably be able to tell he struggles with the things he struggles with. So when he was getting placed in the public school, they placed him in the autism classroom. And the autism classroom is really catered towards kids who are lower functioning, lots of like toiletry needs and communication boards. And that really wasn't Logan, but that's the only place that they had to put him. So when he struggled there, the only other two choices they made available to us is therapeutic day school or the emotionally disturbed classroom were the only two options for him. And neither one fit him very well. There was no high functioning autistic classroom. So we toured both and we made a really hard decision to put him in a therapeutic day school. And from there, I feel like his behaviors really expounded on themselves. He was learning bad behaviors that he was already being demonstrated around him. He was a very violent kiddo. Everybody I think sees the amazing kid he is today, but just remembering how hard it was, until he was in his teens, preteens, it was a daily challenge, and just raising my youngest child, getting through work, my marriage, and just understanding what was needed to be done to give Logan his best shot at adulthood was really putting those things in place when he was younger. So we were really fortunate to get connected with Autism Home Support. And they came to our house for like 8 hours a week. And they would just do therapy in the basement. So my family and I, we didn't go out and do things at night because we needed to be home for Logan's therapy. And he graduated from that at the age of 13. And that was just the most amazing moment of my life because he didn't qualify for that service anymore. That was really, I feel like his turning point. And that's when middle school started. And so in middle school, he was in instructional classes. But my biggest excitement for him is when he finally got to do sports. I used to be so jealous when parents would post online like, oh my gosh, another soccer game. And I just remember thinking what I would give to go to a soccer game instead of sitting through therapy every night. And so I got to experience that in middle school. teacher, and that as a middle school parent, and that was so amazing. He got involved in golf and bowling and swimming, and this whole world opened to him, and he really started turning a corner. And then we got the dyslexia, and that really helped him with his reading. Now he's reading at about third grade reading level, as opposed to a kindergarten. He didn't know all the sounds a couple years ago. So that's been a huge journey for him. But yeah, just super proud of the kiddo he is, but it was a road to get here for sure.
Yeah. And there was so much in there that I want to try to unpack a few things that you said, and thank you for sharing so honestly, because I could see it, you know, that it was painful to talk about, and that it's not who he is now, but it's who he needed to be at the time for him to be who he is now, and for you to go through those experiences, I believe, so that you can share with others, so that others can learn how to navigate some of those waters as well. There's so much that when I've spoken to parents, and when I wrote the book, went this way, it'll be easier to see it. In talking with the parents that I interviewed for that book, there was a lot of what you said in that book as well. You know, that the parents were given choice A and choice B, and that was it. And that's not it. You know, schools are supposed to try to provide something before saying, you know, well, it's A or B. Well, okay, so we try A, and maybe A doesn't work, but we need to try. When we talk about least restrictive environment, and again, not a lawyer, but least restrictive environment, the definition is being in the home school, in the school closest to where the student lives. So even if you have multiple buildings in a district, whichever building is closest to where the student lives, and in the general education classroom. And so to just throw out there that, well, it's either a therapeutic day school or the self-contained, fully instructional, special education, emotionally disabilities class. No, there's other options, but people don't know that. And I do want to have you, if you don't mind, describe what a therapeutic day school is. I personally, until having a lot of interactions with therapeutic day schools, didn't really understand them. And so if you wouldn't mind describing what that is, so people have maybe a better understanding.
It's a special campus outside usually of the public school system. And it's true for the ones that neighbor in our areas, is it really is a feeder for several districts in our area, where students are sent that show behaviors that are outside of what a school can accommodate with. So in this case, and lots of times they might have special needs as well, but it's really kind of a last resort of where a kiddo goes where they need intensive behavioral therapy or assistance outside of what the school can provide.
Thank you for that. And again, referring back to my book, in my chapter, I talk about that when I first got into special education, I lived overseas on a military base, and we didn't have the option of any therapeutic day schools. And so we had to figure out, what do we do with these kiddos? And I was able to see massive transformations because we got the training, because we learned from other people what could work. We had tried all the things that, at that time I was still a paraprofessional, and we had tried all the things that the teacher, the special education teacher, knew how to try and had found to try, and it still wasn't enough. And so we had to have someone from the outside come in and observe and give us ideas. And I think today, because we can send kids away, that we don't put enough energy and effort into trying to keep them at the home school. And so you know, in this there was the kindergarten classroom, and there were like 30 kids in the kindergarten classroom. They all learned negative things, but also positive things. They learned that it can take some time, just like with your son. It took years, but look at how great he's doing now. And I don't think he would probably be doing that great if it wasn't for the interventions that you kept going after and the diagnoses that you're like, something else is going on. And to just say, well, he has autism and he's not going to read, to keep pushing those kinds of things for both your kids. I hate that parents have to push versus schools just offering.
And I really think that's where my benefit is as an educator, because I know the other side of the coin, where I think a lot of parents don't have that benefit. But to know that you can say in those IEP meetings, you can say, no, I want more. I want different. My son needs different. And knowing they have to fill that need. It is frustrating being on the other side of the coin, where you're like, well, I just wish that parent would say this. And you want to scream at the meetings, but I can't. But just being informed is such a powerful tool.
Well, when you're in those meetings and you want to scream at the parents and tell them to ask for, that's when you just slide my business card across the table. You go, reach out to this person. Yes. She might be able to give you some information.
Yeah, for sure.
Because of having the educator piece, I've just been blessed by the Lord with such great ability. And I truly believe that it comes from him to be able to see really what's being said and look beyond the words that are being used, to really get families and schools to be able to collaborate with one another. I have a situation that I'm dealing with. It's been a few month long situation, and it was almost the exact same scenario that we were just talking about, where the school wanted to send the student to a therapeutic day school. And I was like, no, there's way, way too much that has not been tried here. And we're not just going to send them. And not that therapeutic day schools are bad. I don't want anybody to get that impression that that's what I'm saying.
But there are things that
homeschool districts can try. Well, now here we are a few months later, and the same people who were saying, like, this kid needs to go, are like, oh my gosh, he's doing so great with these interventions that we've implemented. And he's such a great kid. Yeah.
Funny how that works.
Right? Yeah. And it's been amazing. And I've had multiple stories like that, where but the parent had to bring me in. That's what frustrates me, is why didn't the school just do this? Why did they force the parent to go outside the school building and find somebody? And I mean, yeah, it's job security for me, but I would rather not. I would rather that the schools are doing these things without the parents having to bring someone like myself in.
It's so true. When a parent walks in with an advocate, everyone sits up a little bit straighter. And we've had to explore those avenues as parents as well.
Yeah. And I hope that, you know, it's been good situations. I know there's also bad advocates that make things worse and don't make things better. And so I hope for you, you know, it turned out that it was a better situation, or a good situation. And what sort of things do you see for both Milo and Logan's futures, knowing the limits that they've already busted through to this point, and knowing they still have several more years of education? What are your hopes and dreams for them, that you really believe that they're not just a wish list, but that they'll actually come to fruition because of their support and their knowledge and skills?
I think when I was in school, the only end route that was ever suggested or encouraged was to go to college. I really feel like there's been a turn in the last 10 years of, like, you know, there's other avenues that you can take besides college and be successful as in such a trade school, as one example. So I, my hope is that Milo will want to go to college. He definitely has all of the right stuff to make that a successful option for him. He hasn't shown a whole lot of interest in what he wants to do. I mean, I knew I wanted to be a teacher since I was like five. So the whole idea of not knowing what you want to do is very foreign to me. And I'm just trying to just go along with it, even though it's very difficult.
Same. So I wanted to be a teacher since I was nine.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, this idea of people not knowing what they want to do is completely crazy, but it's, I guess there's some people who don't want to be teachers. With Logan, I don't know what his future is going to look like. He graduates next year. I can't even wrap my mind around it, but whatever he does, I want him to be happy and successful. So, my husband's a mechanic, and so he has my son try to get interested in automotive. My son, I think, does it sometimes just to be able to spend time with dad, but I don't know if it really interests him the way it absolutely interests my husband. So it's going to be interesting to see where he lands. I say when I was pregnant with Milo, I really wanted a little girl. And I get kind of emotional about it because I think God gave me Milo for Logan. I think them both being the same sex and having those experiences of boys doing what boys like to do, a rough house and play sports. And I don't know if that connection would have come necessarily with a sister, not as much, I should say. I had a brother, so I know how that would look, but, but I say God gave me Milo for Logan so that he'll watch after Logan, far beyond when we've always kind of let Milo do that. You know, you're here to watch after your brother as your brother is to watch after you. And you both watch after them in different ways. My oldest is all brute force. He thinks he's big muscles and he's there to protect him physically. But I know Milo's job is to protect Logan's heart and emotionally. And they both fill those roles very well as siblings.
Oh, that's very beautiful. I love that. And yeah, there was something, and we just have about 10 minutes, so I don't know how long we want, or even if answer this question, but you mentioned earlier, you know, that as Logan was having so many of his struggles and as Milo was, born and too with some differences, that put a lot of stress on your marriage. And I don't think oftentimes we, especially as educators, think about that, what it's like at home. You know, I mean, we as educators, we see the kid from 7 to 4 or whatever hours school is, 9 to 3, whatever. But we don't realize and we don't empathize with what it's like at home. Are you comfortable sharing? And again, please feel completely free to say you would rather not talk about that part.
No, my husband and I were still very much together. We've been together for 25 years. Married for a little less than that. And I think my husband also, because dyslexia is genetic, which I have come to learn in my research. And so I, without a doubt, believe that my husband also has dyslexia and has his own personal struggles when he was in school as well. So I think it definitely made my husband more empathetic to what my son was going through because my husband had very similar struggles. So I think my husband's understanding of Logan's side of things and then my understanding on the educational side made us both the right parents for Logan and what he needed. And I think that we just knew together we were stronger than if we weren't. But there was lots of nights I'd go home and, in tears. And I was lucky to have my husband there to talk to. I really empathize with families that don't have that partner who's supportive of that, because I could see it definitely being a huge rift in a family, because it's very easy to point blame, to judge, because there's some days like, oh my gosh, like I don't think I made the right decision, like I still beat myself up that I shouldn't have kept him in therapy day school so long, and to know that my partner was there who made those same decisions with me. Like, nope, that's what we did because we thought that's what was best. And we're not gonna dwell on it because it's not gonna do anybody any good. I was very fortunate also to have my parents be very supportive as well, to have that, I don't know what I'd do without my dad. But just, yeah, that family unit just needs to be as equally supportive and strong, because of that, it definitely add a whole nother layer of complication to raising a child with neurodivergent needs.
Yeah, and I think, again, that we, you know, that line that you said, like, you know, your spouse said to you, we did that, we made that decision together with the knowledge that we had at the time. And that is very comforting. I do want to reiterate that even for single parents, that whatever decisions you make at the time that you make them, you're basing that on the knowledge and the experience that you have in that moment and what you think is best at that time, and to try not to beat yourself up looking back. And you know, what you said, like, oh, you think you might have left him in the therapeutic day school too long. You know, none of us have the ability to see the future. And, you know, we also don't know, when we're in the future and looking at the past, if we had gone down a different route, would it have been better? You know, you can't redo life. So, you know, trying to accept and give yourself grace and mercy that you did the best you could with what you had at the time. And I think it's Maya Angelou that says, you, now that you know better, you can do differently. I think she actually says, you now that you know better, you can do better. I'm not sure that we can definitely say it's always doing better, because we just don't know. And so I really appreciate that, you know, you had that support of your spouse, of your parents. That saying, it takes a village to raise a child, is true for any family, but I believe it's even more important for families who are raising kiddos with neurodivergence to have that as well. And unfortunately, again, the majority, it seems, of the parents that I have interacted with kiddos who are neurodivergent, they never feel like they have a tribe. Even if they do, they still feel so alone in so many instances. And I've tried different things to try to help that. And I don't know how to help that feeling. Because I think my understanding, at least, is that you just don't think anybody can feel what you're feeling. And then especially the thoughts that you wish you didn't have.
I think social media definitely makes that much harder. As a special needs parent, when you go on social media and you see everybody have these wonderful lives, or at least, you know, that's a perception when you go on social media, right? And then all you do is just think about, like, you know, you're holding down your kiddo while they're screaming because they don't want their, you know, their grilled cheese sandwich cut in a triangle, but they want it squares. And just thinking, like, you'll never get out of this, but you will. You will. And you'll be better on the other side of so are your kiddos.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate that very much. Because I have not parented, as I said, first, more than one child. And second, my daughter dealt with some anxious thoughts and things of that nature, but nothing like I've heard of, you know, families dealing with someone with dyslexia or autism that have just a different type. And it's more prevalent. It's more every minute of every day. I hope that I'm not saying that one is greater or less than. I mean, neurodivergence is, you know, I don't know. I'm kind of spinning. I'm trying to figure out what I'm trying to say, but, you know, I've, again, like somebody with autism or Down syndrome, or most of the students most of the students in my book, it wasn't every minute, every second of every day, 24/7, 365 days a year for their entire life. And I'm not sure that I've dealt with that as a parent. Maybe my daughter would say differently, but maybe those anxious thoughts were always in her head all the time, 24/7, 365. But my anxious thoughts are not like that. So I shouldn't probably do that. I guess I'm projecting my experience onto her, which I shouldn't do. So Violet, if you're watching or listening, I apologize for doing that. Jessica, thank you for being my guest today. We just have a couple more minutes, and I just want to give you the opportunity right now. If you have, anything that you wanted to talk about today that we didn't cover, or if you have any final words of encouragement or advice for educators or parents or even students, now is that opportunity to take that.
So like I kind of hinted at, I feel like when 10 years ago, I felt like I couldn't be where we are today. Every day was a struggle. Every day was emotionally exhausting. And every day we had a fight, I feel like, every day to do what was necessary to just keep my family afloat. I really am excited to say that I think we're at the other end of it. We still have a little bit to go, but I really am just so proud of where my family is today. Logan is in the National Honor Society. He's playing varsity bowling and he's doing varsity baseball. And we're still working on making him some friends outside of school. That's still a challenge, but he's happy and he's flourishing. My youngest is really coming into who he is as a person instead of being in Logan's shadows, who he is individually. Has really been exciting to see him flourishing into that on his own. And that as a parent, continually doing what you think is best for your kiddo, because it's the best that you can do. It's just giving your best. And you're gonna just look back when the years go by, you're like, boy, that was tough. We got through it. And I bet I always had an amazing kiddo. It was just a little bit harder to see maybe when they were younger. And I just appreciate the opportunity to come in here and telling my kid's story. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I very much appreciate you as a person and you as being my guest today and all that you shared and your honesty. If you are watching or listening and you know someone who has a story similar to Jessica's, maybe it's you, maybe it's someone that you are friends or family with, please have them reach out to me, because that's what I'm trying to do, is to share all the stories, because I want to focus on abilities, not disabilities. I want to focus on positives, not negatives. And I just feel that the more of these episodes I can bring to people, the more perspectives we can change and the better all of us will have in life. And the better our lives in general and our society will be. And so I just want to say one last time, we know who we are, but not who we will be. And I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Hey, parents and teachers, are you tired of IEP meetings that feel like a battle? Let's put an end to the tension and create a collaborative, calm, and respectful environment together. Shelly Kino, your go-to IEP consultant, can transform your meetings into positive and productive experiences. With Shelly Kino, your child is her top priority, your voice is heard, and you become confident. Shelly Kino is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Visit www.shellykino.com for more information and set up your free 20-minute consultation today. That's shellykino.com, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y-K-E-N-O-W.